The idea of building machines that can think like humans, it's a branch of science that's really taken off. The term machine learning is used to describe this idea of teaching computers to learn in really the same way we humans do. For better or for worse, this big data, it's out there, so we want to do something smart with it. Rebecca Willett is a UW-Madison electrical and computer engineering professor and fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. She's the Harvey D. Spangler Scholar, and her expertise is in machine learning. She's one of six experts talking big data this Saturday during the Wisconsin Science Festival. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Mark Craven joins us here in studio. He's a professor in the Department of Biostatistics and Medical Informatics at UW. He's a director of the Center for Predictive Computational Phenotyping. It's one of the National Institute for Health's Centers of Excellence for Big Data Computing. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Rebecca, let's start with you. We use the phrase big data, and we think we know what it means, but help us break it down for us. What is big data?
So big data corresponds to just an extremely large data set that we can analyze using computers in order to find patterns or trends or make predictions. So one good classical example would be if you go to Amazon.com. Amazon is keeping track of what you've purchased and what every other customer has purchased or looked at and not purchased. And what they'd like to do is to use that information to decide what products you might like to purchase in the future and make recommendations to you. Another example is something called ImageNet, where we've collected millions of images. And from those, we try to figure out how we can take some new image and determine what the content of that image is. Is there a cat in it? Is there a house in it? Is it an image of some kids on the beach? And we'd like to be able to do that in an automated way. So when we have these huge collections of data, big data, we can make more accurate decisions and predictions like that.
And this data isn't always clean. It can be messy, I understand. What is this messy data?
Yeah, data can be extremely messy. In fact, Mark maybe has some excellent examples from medical health record data that show exactly how messy it can be.
Yeah, so there's often issues of noise in measurements, and so that might be one challenge if you have measurements coming, say, from some kind of a sensor. Or you might have issues where things get recorded that aren't actually quite true. So this comes up, as Rebecca mentioned, in the context of electronic health records, where sometimes things that will get entered will be things that are being billed for, maybe a diagnosis, because that's something that the doctors checked, they wanted to bill for it, but the patient didn't actually have that diagnosis. So it's just kind of an example that when you're actually looking at these records or having automated systems do that, you have to take into account what are some of the sources of noise, some of the sources of error that occur there.
Perhaps some of the sources is just the human error of it, of taking down the right code. These codes are maybe 5-6 digits long, and they are perhaps even on a screen with a whole lot of other numbers. There's a lot of noise there, right?
Certainly, yeah. And on the screen, there's also cases sometimes where an individual will pick a code that's easy to pick, maybe the first item in a list instead of something that's actually more descriptive.
Yeah. So it also depends on how detail-oriented we are in terms of what data you get to work with. So when you get this data, what are you doing with it, Mark? How are you using big data?
So we have a center here that's focused on using big data that pertains to biology or medicine, and using that to try and get a better understanding of the biology underlying various diseases like Alzheimer's and autism and asthma, as well as using that data to try to come up with better methods for doing diagnosis and prognosis and treatment planning.
And so how is that going? I mean, how are you making headway? Because we've also heard of personalized medicine in a better understanding things like cancer and being able to look at big data in order to treat various cancers very specifically to an individual person.
Right. So this is all very closely connected to personalized medicine. If we think about the kinds of data we can get to describe a given individual or a given patient, right, we can have data that comes from their electronic health record, from their usual encounters with the health system, or data that's coming from some kind of imaging. So, say, subjects in an Alzheimer's study are undergoing regular brain imaging. We can get data that comes from wearable sensors like Fitbits. We can now get, for many conditions, we can get detailed molecular-level measurements. And so now if you think about trying to do personalized medicine, right, trying to better diagnose a condition or to make some kind of treatment decision, the potential is that you can use all this data to really precisely characterize a condition that a given patient has.
Rebecca, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Mark is exactly right. I think there's a huge amount of potential for big data in things like precision medicine. But there are also a large number of pretty significant challenges, which is why we've got these large teams of people conducting research here. So when you talk about big data, typically people characterize it with what they call the four Vs. So the first one is volume. When we talk about big data, there's just a large volume of data. If you think about all the health records of all the people in the United States, that's a huge Wow. amount of data. You can't store it on any one machine even. The second V is velocity. So data is changing over time. People's health conditions evolve, or maybe we're tracking weather patterns and the weather is changing. And so we want to have methods that can take that data and adapt to changing conditions. The third one is variety. So a lot of times we don't have nice, clean data that's just imagery, for instance, but we would have a combination of imagery and, in the context of these health records, chart data, doctor's notes, maybe the result of an MRI scan, some genetic information. They're just all different types and sources of data that aren't necessarily similar to one another. And then the fourth one is veracity. A lot of times that data is not entirely trustworthy for some reasons that we talked about earlier. And so some of the core research questions are, how do we develop methods that can reliably extract useful information from this data in the face of those four big Vs, or those four big challenges?
Very big challenges. We're talking right now with Rebecca Willett. She is a UW-Madison Electrical and Computer Engineering professor and a fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. Mark Craven is here as well. He's a professor in the Department of Biostatistics and Medical Informatics at UW. We're discussing big data, machine learning, and what we can do with all of this data, how it filters into our life every single day. And so let's get down to companies and organizations and how they amass all of this data, and what is meaningful to them, what is not, how are they using it? Rebecca, can you start?
Yeah, it varies a lot depending on the organization. So there are some companies like Amazon or Facebook where they are just monitoring how customers use their websites or their platforms and using that to make good predictions about them. But there are other settings where we're much more deliberate and conducting experiments to collect data. So in astronomy, we've got satellites that are collecting terabytes of data every single day. Images of the sun or of planets or of other features. And we want to make some sense of that and try to understand something about how the universe works. But it's a much more kind of controlled setting. Similarly, in drug discovery, we might conduct lots of experiments testing molecules to decide whether they have some potential as a future therapeutic drug. And we could try to exhaustively test every possible molecule, but that would just take hundreds or thousands of years. And so what we'd like to do is to be smart about the way we choose which experiments to run. And so again, we're very deliberate about what kinds of data we collect so that we can make the most accurate predictions as efficiently as possible.
And Mark, we're going to be heading here into a break, but what are your tools of the trade very quickly? Are you scribbling on whiteboards, programming computers?
Both of the above, as well as interacting very closely with clinicians and biologists. So kind of the starting point for what we often do is to use existing methods for trying to elicit information from big data. But we know those methods have limitations. We often run up against those limitations. And so a lot of what we're trying to do within the center is to develop innovative new methods that get around those weaknesses of existing methods. And so that involves some work scribbling at the whiteboard. Some of it is taking ideas that are developed there and implementing them in software.
Machine learning is the study of algorithms that use data to learn, generalize, predict. Think of the terminology predictive analytics. We're talking big data right now with Rebecca Willett, a UW-Madison electrical and computer engineering professor. Mark Craven is here as well, professor in the Department of Biostatistics and Medical Informatics. Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Where do you notice big data in your life? Join us. We'll be back after this news update. The truth is, people leave their digital footprints everywhere, and computers, our machines, can learn from these human clues. About 3 billion people on the planet have access to the internet, and our digital footprints make for a staggering amount of data. Computers are becoming more effective at replicating how the human brain works, and that's why machine learning and artificial intelligence are becoming more and more a part of our everyday lives. We're learning about what big data can do this hour with Mark Craven. He is a professor in the Department of Biostatistics and Medical Informatics at UW-Madison. He directs the Center for Predictive Computational Phenotyping. And Rebecca Willett is here. She's an electrical and computer engineering professor at UW and a fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. She's speaking about big data on Saturday during the Wisconsin Science Festival. Join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What should scientists consider as they build technology capable of learning? Do you see any moral issues, or is this a future without downsides? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rebecca, give us a sense of how machines learn. How do we teach them?
Machines learn very similarly to the way a young child learns. So when we are teaching a kid, for instance, how to tell the difference between a cat and a dog, we show them all kinds of picture books and all kinds of examples. And eventually the kid picks up on the fact that generally dogs are a little bigger and they've got a different ear shape and a different snout shape. So they extract these features from these animals and they use that to make decisions about whether they think it's a cat or a dog. And so machines can operate in very much the same way. We would provide a machine with thousands or millions of pictures of cats and dogs. And they would measure features in those images. Things like, well, how big is the animal or what is the ear shape? And they would create rules internally, mathematical rules that say, well, if I want to decide if it is a cat or a dog, then I'm going to look at some weighted sum of the size and the pointiness of the ear. And if this weighted sum is greater than zero, then I say it's a dog. And if this weighted sum is less than zero, then I say it's a cat. So that's a very simple rule. And by itself, it's not very powerful. But this is the basic building block that almost all machine learning is based on. So I can take this block and I can make a bunch of other blocks like it and join them together and form a very complicated and sophisticated way of taking an image and figuring out, well, what is its content? What is inside this image? And so we use these tools in order to, and tons and tons of data and lots of computation.
Lots of practice.
And lots of practice to make good predictions.
So how foolproof is machine learning? Once you're able to teach something, some type of protocol, is it error-free after that? Does the machine ever unlearn?
That's a great question. And I would say it's not at all foolproof, and this is why it is such an active research area. So there are some areas like image recognition. So if you do a Google search for pictures of cats, Google's really effective at it, where we've had these enormous successes. But there are many, many things that we don't know or understand about how these different tools work. And so if you're going to use this tool to recommend, for Netflix to recommend that I watch Twilight on Saturday, then, and I don't like it, I haven't lost a whole lot. But if we're going to use these tools to guide a self-driving car and they fail, then I really care. So I want to understand exactly when and how these different methods are going to fail. And unfortunately, the dirty little secret is that there's all kinds of things that we do not understand about how these things work, or in particular, when they're going to fail.
The stakes can get really high once you're talking about a human life in a self-driving car, for instance, or a diagnosis, perhaps, in treating an illness.
Right. That's exactly right. And I mean, even with image recognition, one of the use cases that's the poster child of machine learning really being effective, there have been some surprising results where people would feed in a picture of a panda, and the algorithm would say, yes, this is a panda. And then they take that same picture of a panda and they make these tiny little changes to each of the pixels. And they're so tiny that when you or I look at the image, it looks exactly the same. We can't tell that anything changed at all. And they feed it into exactly the same machine learning engine. And that comes back and says, it's a gibbon. It's a monkey. And so we don't understand exactly how to prevent that kind of huge change in the output based on a tiny little change in the input. Mm. And those are things that are super important if you're going to use these tools to do things like make healthcare decisions or to guide a self-driving car.
Oh, so you're saying like teaching nuance, teaching kind of the finer thing, it requires some human capacity, perhaps. It's not so rigid in trying to get these outcomes.
Yeah, I think there are multiple aspects to this. So one of them is trying to just understand mathematically, like what kinds of changes can we make to the data going into these systems, and how is it going to change what's coming out? So how stable is this as a system? And so that requires a lot of experimentation and a lot of mathematical analyses. But there's also questions of, well, how do we train these systems to begin with? What kind of example images or example data points are we giving them? And this is pretty important because it can guide how fair or accurate the outputs are. So, for instance, if I'm trying to teach a machine how to tell the difference between cats and dogs, and all my pictures of cats are indoors and all my pictures of dogs are on the grass, then my machine might think anything that's on the grass is a dog.
Oh.
And so, I mean, that's a pretty simple toy example. But when we start talking about huge machines with huge quantities of data, then we really have to worry about, is there some sort of implicit bias in just the data I'm feeding into these machines that's going to skew my results and give me very poor outputs and poor predictions.
And Mark, you work in biomedicine. How does big data impact the research you're doing in asthma?
So we're looking at doing a couple of things regarding asthma. So one is to get a better understanding of the disease. And the second is to be able to better take care of patients by predicting when they're likely to encounter some kind of severe asthma attack coming up. So in the former case, what's happening now at Wisconsin and elsewhere is putting together cohorts of kids from around the country who have been studied for asthma. And it gets really interesting because of the types of data that you can acquire that are relevant and the types of things that have been measured.
Like what?
So if you want to understand asthma in kids, you want to gather data on things like, well, what's their lung function like, clinical things like that that you can measure when they come in, as well as you want to understand what kind of environmental exposures have they had. So have they had pets in the home, or what kind of components in the dust do they have at their homes? You can also gather data about their microbiome. So what is the population of little microorganisms living on the kids and inside of them? What does that look like? And how does that affect how their disease progresses? So there's a large study now that is pulling together kids from all around the country, gathering all of these types of data that we can in order to better understand how the different trajectories for the disease look like, right? There's some kids who get asthma and then it goes away, or some where they get it and it stays at about the same level of severity, and some where it gets better. And we don't even have a great characterization of what these different disease trajectories look like. So we want to better understand them and understand them down to the molecular level, right? Down to the level of abundances of different molecules that are varying inside of their body. And then given that understanding of what are these different disease patterns look like, we can then ask, well, what are the genetics that tend to put someone on the track for one disease trajectory or another? And we can ask, what are the environmental exposures that might affect what kind of path you go down? And so all of this, if we develop this better understanding, this, of course, can help in prevention of asthma, in better treatment, in better understanding how to manage the disease for kids.
It sounds like you're just gorging on data.
Well, I would say
if I say so myself.
We never have as much as we'd like to. We usually have enough that we have challenges doing things with it, but we always want more.
So I think related to that is that, you know, there's different kinds of or aspects of the data. So when we talked about images, we said we train these machines with millions of images, and each one has labels. Does this image have a cat, a dog, a house, a bird, whatever? And so in other applications, we might have a lot of raw data, but we might be missing those labels. So it's easy to get people to help us label snapshot images. But now if I want to look at images of cells so that I can do better healthcare, I need a certain level of expertise. And so it's not as easy to get millions and millions of images that have been carefully labeled by cell biologists or pathologists. And so we have all these images, we have huge quantities of data, but we're missing kind of this key element of this label information. And so again, one of the main research areas within machine learning is, if we don't have very many labels, what should we do? How can we efficiently utilize sort of limited human resources? Or how can we cope with a small number of labels?
We're talking right now with Rebecca Willett. She is a UW-Madison electrical and computer engineering professor and a fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. Mark Craven is here as well. He's a professor in the Department of Biostatistics and Medical Informatics at UW. And we are bringing you into the conversation as well, 800-642-1234. Where do you notice big data in your life? What questions do you have about machine learning and big data and biomedicine? Is it obvious where big data is, or did it take a while for you to realize how an organization collects and uses your information? Have you seen an algorithm perhaps gone wrong? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John from Menominee called. He wonders how to start working in machine learning. What skills or training do you need to join the workforce? Can people switch from other careers to this field?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a growing number of degree programs and certificate programs that train people in the foundations and the use of machine learning, including here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Statistics, computer science, electrical engineering, and math are all engaged in developing these programs. The kind of core skills that are required are a combination of things like mathematics and computer science and statistics. So I think there's a common misperception that if you can program, you can handle big data. And certainly there are some nice toolboxes out there. So if I've got a toolbox and I've got some data, I can just plug the data in. But then it's a little bit, it's easy to make a mistake and not recognize it. Or it's easy for your machine learning algorithm to go wrong and for you to not even notice. And so that's where understanding the underlying math and statistics can be extremely useful and important, especially if you want to develop these new algorithms and new technologies.
And what about fairness in machine learning? Why is fairness an open landscape, an open question, if you will? And I'll have both of you answer, yeah.
Well, so one example is the following. So imagine that I'm running a bank and I want to make loans and I want to make a prediction of who is going to be most likely to repay my loan, because those are the people I want to give the loans to. So legally, I can't make that decision based on race. I shouldn't be making that decision based on race. But if I've got a machine learning algorithm and a bunch of data that doesn't explicitly include race, there could be other things in there that are somehow correlated with race or good indicators of what someone's race might be. And I might start using those indicators, maybe even inadvertently. So I could start making decisions that are somehow very correlated with race without doing it explicitly because it's somehow buried under the surface of my machine learning algorithm. And this is something that would be deeply wrong. And one research area is figuring out how to make safeguards that prevent that. Another example is with these electronic health records. You could imagine some communities that are somewhat more segregated, where you have people in one race going to one set of clinics and another race going to a different set of clinics. And we might ignore race we might analyze this electronic health record and say people of one race are responding to a particular treatment better or worse than people in a different race. And that might not be the case at all. It might be a side effect of the fact that people in different races are going to different clinics, and maybe those clinics are prescribing drugs differently or giving different instructions to their patients or any number of other factors that aren't really because of race, but really because of which doctors people are going to see. And so, again, we want to be careful about what conclusions we draw from these algorithms and these kind of hidden correlations that underlie the data that we feed into these algorithms can easily lead us astray unless we're very careful.
And Mark, what do you have to be careful about as you draw in massive amounts of data and interpret it?
So, as Rebecca mentioned, we have to be concerned about these fairness issues. We also have to be concerned about privacy, right? To make sure that details about someone's human health have not been revealed in any way inadvertently. And so when we work with the data, we're always working with data that's been de-identified. That is, names, addresses, any kind of identifying information has been stripped out. Mm-hmm. But there's still the potential that some kind of identifying information can be leaked out, or the data could be joined up with another data set that would reveal someone. So both from the kind of the policy and the practice side, we have to be very careful, but also there's a lot of technical work on how can we ensure that privacy is preserved. And I guess following up on what Rebecca said about fairness, there's a lot of technical work being done there as well. To develop methods so that we can formally specify fairness. We can tell our machine learning algorithm, here are the conditions we want the system to meet to ensure that it's fair, and that we can then guide the learning system to ensure that it comes up with a learned system that is fair according to our specifications.
New artificial intelligence is helping researchers to teach machines to spot suicidal tendencies and help identify those at risk for committing suicide. That's one of the latest developments this week in machine learning that was published in the MIT Technology Review. The success of the study reveals the great potential there is for artificial intelligence to help in the area of psychiatry, not to mention in biomedicine, detecting tumors, predicting depressive disorders. Some scientists say the key to more personalized and precise care and eventual cure for diseases lies largely in our ability to use big data, which is what we're talking about this hour. We're discussing the wide-ranging landscape that is machine learning with Rebecca Willett. She is a UW-Madison Electrical and Computer Engineering Professor Fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. Mark Craven is here, professor in the Department of Biostatistics and Medical Informatics. You can join in as well, 800-642-1234. How do you see big data at work in your life? How has it changed your life for the better or for the worse? Join in, 800-642-1234. Here's a machine learning scientist job description that was posted in recent days from Amazon. Do you apply machine learning to big data problems? Are you excited by analyzing and modeling terabytes of data that solve real-world problems? We love data and have lots of it. We're looking for a whip smart engineer capable of using machine learning and statistical techniques to create state-of-the-art solutions for non-trivial and arguably unsolved problems. This job description has been our jumping off point, actually, on machine learning and big data this hour. Rebecca Willett and Mark Craven, stay with us. Rebecca is a UW-Madison electrical and computer engineering professor and a fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. Mark is a professor in the Department of Biostatistics and Medical Informatics at UW. He's director of the Center for Predictive Computational Phenotyping. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Are you a machine learning scientist? What are you working on? Do you want to get into this branch of science? Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Mark first in Altoona. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Thank you. Let me get my notes here because I have a recollection of Wisconsin Public Radio that doesn't require a response before I get to my main point, which will be about humans.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Mark. We need to get right away to your question. So, Mark, I'm sorry we had to pod you down there. But we are talking about machine learning. And as I mentioned, Rebecca, this job description, this is non-trivial things here that we are talking about, big, important things. Can machines replicate what human beings can do in their lives? Can machines replace humans is what I'm asking.
Yeah, that's a good question, and people have been talking about it a lot recently in the popular media. I would say right now, absolutely not. There's a lot of things that humans are very good at that machines just can't compete with. There's a classical test called a Turing test that people use to kind of evaluate whether machines are somehow really conscious or competitive with humans. And the idea is this: if I wanted to say that a machine is really on par with a human in terms of intelligence, then I should be able to have a conversation somehow with that machine and not be able to tell whether I'm having a conversation with the machine or with a human. Mm-hmm. They're basically indistinguishable. But that's a somewhat simple test, and we have been able to make machines that very effectively mimic humans.
Alexa, I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's right.
I talk with her all the time. It's
pretty incredible.
Yeah.
But it's also a somewhat simple test. I mean, there are not machines that can design new experiments and make scientific discoveries. There are not machines that can win the New Yorker cartoon caption contest. There are a lot of things that involve creativity and thinking out of the box and thinking about things that are totally unlike any example we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. That we don't see machines able to do at this point by any means.
Mark, I would think machines perhaps could do a better job of detecting a tumor, for instance. But in biomedicine, in the area you're working in, can machines do a better job than humans at figuring out what is coming up next in how we treat disease and how we cure diseases?
In some cases, yes. So there have been a number of studies that have demonstrated that machines can make better diagnoses than many doctors. And often what they're showing is that they can make better decisions than doctors who are maybe not the best experts in that particular disease, but they can do it better than your ordinary doctor who's not such an expert. So I think what we're moving towards is not having machines replace doctors or humans in most daily activities, but instead enabling them to make better decisions, right? Thinking about them as assistants like Alexa that can help you do your tasks, right? So can we develop computer systems that can work with doctors that can say, maybe you didn't think about this particular condition, or here, you might want to compare this patient to this other patient who's had a very similar history.
So almost like these very helpful sidekicks.
Exactly.
Let's take a call from Tamsin in Lafarge. Hi, Tamsin, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I guess I'm thinking I'm a PA, medical provider, in a small rural clinic. And
a physician assistant?
A physician assistant, uh-huh. Correct. And just thinking about the quality of input of data for looking at these meta questions. And I'm not embarrassed to say it, but I think that it is true that the quality of my diagnostic coding is really not as good as the quality of someone who's actually a coder. And I think that that's really pretty accurate among providers. These days with electronic medical records, we are the ones who are being required to do the coding. We have to do it to be able to order a lab test or to be able to complete a visit. We actually have to put in a diagnosis code. And I just wonder how that quality is going to be affecting the quality of the data as it comes out, and the quality of the learning as it goes on with the information.
So great question, Tamsin. And this is exactly one of the sources of potential noise that we talked about earlier that we want to make sure that we take into account. So yes, certainly if there's the quality of the data is not great, that's going to affect the algorithms that are trying to learn from it. But when we have a good understanding of what kinds of noise or what kinds of mistakes there might be in the data, then what we can do are several things. So we can design algorithms that are robust to that noise, that they don't rely too much on any one code or rely too much on what they've seen in the record for any given patient. But also, this is a case where we can look to other sources of evidence. So in addition to just looking at the codes that have been entered by a provider like you or by some coder, we can have systems that are looking at the text narrative description that are typed in by clinicians and are trying to interpret that text and ask, is what's written in the text there, is that agreeing with the code? And should I really believe that the patient has this code that's been entered once I read the description?
So there are these safety nets in place, perhaps, to try to find some discrepancy.
Yeah, you could think about them as safety nets. Something else that we're always really careful to do is to test our systems. So we think about the learning process where the system is learned from a set of data. And then very much like you'd like to test kids in a school setting, we test our algorithms. We show them another set of data that they didn't use during the learning process where we know the right answers. And then we can ask, how accurate did the system get the answers for these test cases? So that's kind of another safety net where we can try to vet our systems and make sure that they're really performing as well as we think they should be.
Tamsin, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go to John now in Madison. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. A few weeks ago, they announced a new iteration of the original Go program that actually learned not from compiling and using past references, but it learned on its own over a two-month period and actually beat the Chinese Go master again. And the Chinese Go master said that he actually learned from the computer. And this, to me, is incredibly significant because it says that AI is right around the threshold, maybe 20 years. And I'm wondering, since it looks like AI is being developed in a military context, not only by the U.S., but also the Chinese, do you think that it poses a real threat? I mean, Hawking and a lot of others do.
Rebecca?
Well, I don't think that robots are going to take over the Earth anytime soon. I do think that it is a national security concern that defense organizations around the world are actively interested in how they can best use big data for defending their countries. And it's something that here in the U.S. we definitely worry about and think about quite a bit. But, you know, playing a game of Go is very different than engaging in an armed conflict. Go is very predictable. There's a very precise set of rules. It's very strict. And there's a pretty clear objective, when you're talking about an armed conflict, there can be many competing objectives. You can have people who are behaving in unpredictable ways, and the rules are almost never as clear-cut. And there are pieces of information that we don't always see. It's like playing a game of Go where you can only see part of the board at a time. And so there's a really big gap between a machine that can win a game of Go, which is, I agree, very, very impressive, and really using machines to completely replace human intelligence.
And Mark, as we wrap up here, where do you see big data headed next in your area of expertise, and especially in biomedicine?
So I think what we're going to start to see increasingly is these systems that are acquired through machine learning systems and big data being put into practice, right? So being put on the desktops of doctors to help guide medicine, but also being put into the labs of basic scientists to do things like Rebecca mentioned a few minutes ago, like trying to decide what's the next best experiment to do that will give us the most information about this system we're trying to understand.
And Rebecca, as we wrap up here, how about you? Where do you see big data headed in the future and in the work you do?
Yeah, I think there are two aspects of that. We've talked about some of the technical and research challenges of making sure these things really work in practice and that they're fair. But I also think that there is a huge amount of potential in terms of applications, ranging from trying to analyze gerrymandering in redistricting challenges, trying to improve agriculture and use big data to make crops grow more efficiently and more cheaply, to understanding the human brain or predicting where hurricanes are most likely to land. I think big data has a huge amount of potential in all of these settings, and it's going to be really exciting to see it in action.
Well, Rebecca and Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
That was Mark Craven, a professor in the Department of Biostatistics and Medical Informatics at UW. He's also director of the Center for Predictive Computational Phenotyping. And Rebecca Willett, a UW-Madison Electrical and Computer Engineering professor and fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. She's the Harvey D. Spangler Scholar. Her expertise is in machine learning. She's one of six experts talking big data during the Wisconsin Science Festival. The Big Ideas for Busy People event happens Saturday night at 7 o'clock at the Discovery Building. This hour, the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.